Welcome to the Mobility Podcast. We are, this is Pete Gould with Shared Mobility Strategies, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Greg Rodriguez with Best Best and Krieger. Views are our own, as always.
And we are recording today live from the Convention Center here in D.C. At ITS America's annual conference.
As it's literally being set up outside.
Yeah. And so we are very excited. Today we have a great guest, Amy Ford, who is the director of the Mobility on Demand Alliance that is being orchestrated by ITS America. And so we are very excited to get into all things mobility on demand, mobility as a service, and you know, particularly on the policy side of things that go into that. So let's start. Amy, you recently joined ITS America, reunited with with Shailen, who was on we just had on for our second time. And so just tell us a little bit about your background.
You bet. Well, you know, I actually am coming to the Mobility on Demand Alliance from the Colorado Department of Transportation. So Shailen looks like he's poaching people yes. out from Colorado, which he did. But I was actually the chief of advanced mobility there at CDOT. And so what that meant is all things technology, all things operations, all things, you know, self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, mobility on demand, even to flying cars, you know, sort of fell in the purview that I worked on. And really the biggest piece of that, and as it translates over here, is how do you sort of sift through all of these changes that are happening in mobility and technology? How do you look at it? How do you see it? And then how do you start bringing it into a Department of Transportation that for the last 100 years has been about building roads and bridges? And how do you transition that kind of technology into that world? And that's what I'm excited to do here with the Mobility on Demand Alliance too, is sort of how at a broader national level, how do you set the framework for this new mobility that we're starting to see that's really transforming how not just people move, but how cargo and data moves too.
That's great. So tell us about the MOD Alliance. What is it? What's the, you know, what is the deliverable and the outcome, you know, that is that you hope to kind of execute?
Well, and the interesting thing, I think, with all of this is, you know, MOD, let's talk about that first, right? You know, no, it's not the name of some like dragon flying around, you know, MOD. It's this mobility on demand. And, you know, it's funny, my parents go, well, I don't understand, you know, what does that mean? And I said, well, you know, it's the idea that people have the ability to seamlessly move. And, you know, historically, you either move in your car or you get onto a bus. And, you know, the idea that now that there are so many services that are out there, and frankly, that 10 years ago didn't exist. I mean, let's be honest about Uber and Lyft really just came into creation, right, in the last 10 years. Between that, between scooters, between bikes, all things that existed before, but how they're fusing now with what mobility is. And the idea as a customer that I can sort of grab at that mobility when I want it, how I want it. So that's what mobility on demand is sort of this vision of the seamless transportation system. But the pieces to that are, how do you do that? How do you create it so that a customer can seamlessly move? How do you create it so a customer maybe could seamlessly pay for all of this? The idea of the alliance is that we bring together both the public sector, the private sector, and academia to sit and talk about how do you further all of this? Because we see it exploding on our streets right now. If you live in a city like Washington, D.C., I mean, you can't walk but to see Uber, Lyft, this scooter, that electric bike, this bike, you name it. I just saw someone, I think it was a joke, but someone was going to drop pogo sticks, electric pogo
is
sticks.
Is it a joke? Because I saw it too.
Know.
We've been joking about that
Did
for a while.
Did you see the pogo sticks yesterday? I saw it. And, you know, I thought, well, gosh, who knows? So who knows what's next? Flying cars, you name it. But the idea that we start looking at what are the obstacles, what are the barriers, but what are the opportunities to sort of fuse and meld these services together. And this is not just a private sector concern. It's not just a public sector concern anymore. It's how do we actually work together? And to be honest, that's a lot of hard work, and that's what the alliance is about. It's how do we tackle some of those challenges? How do we look at the policies? How do we raise the level of awareness of mobility on demand so it really maybe does become and define that future of mobility?
Excellent. And so you guys launched on April 4th, I believe, in Seattle.
We did.
And had your first forum. Can you give us a little kind of recap? You know, what was accomplished there? What were the main concerns you heard from the private sector, concerns or opportunities from the public sector?
Yeah, you know, it's always such an interesting thing when you officially launch something because, you know, obviously we come from ITS America, and so we are able to relate to sort of our members already. You know, we have members who are state DOTs, we have transit agencies, cities, metropolitan planning organizations, you have private sector companies like the auto manufacturers, you have data service folks like Amazon, you have transportation aggregators behind the scene who like help plan for tolling and ticketing and you know, all these things. And that's who we were drawing in at the launch here in April. And really the focus of the launch was to sort of highlight what are those big issues? What are the big topics that people are talking about? And right now when you think about mobility on demand, I think it's easy for folks to say, how is it that I as a customer can get onto my app and I can say, hey, I want to lift over to the light rail, I want to get on the light rail, and I want to scooter over to my office after I get off and then maybe rent a Zipcar when I get home. And you talk about that as sort of the trip, and that's how we want to look and plan at it. But the reality is a mobility on demand is a lot more than that. And that's a lot what we talked about in our launch. So we talked about a couple of things. The biggest were the values of mobility on demand. What is it that drives this? Is it just about personal mobility and making it as easy for them as possible? Or is it about how you do mobility for all? And so this issue of equity and accessibility was a very big topic of conversation. Right now, and I think what we see is with Uber and Lyft and scooters is you create it, you drop it in a city, people use it. But the people who are using it are the people who can easily use it. Maybe they don't have a wheelchair, and so therefore they can easily walk on to a Lyft ride. Maybe they live in a more affluent neighborhood and they're not being redlined, perhaps by drivers who don't want to go into certain neighborhoods. Maybe they have a cell phone that actually has a credit card so they could do an app because they're banked to do that. So you can see inherently by just me saying that, the people who get left behind in some of this conversation. And so that was a big part of it, is how do you drive mobility on demand in a way that fits to a larger accessibility and equity model and also collaborates with the public sector and especially public transport like transit and engages all of that, right? So that was one part of the conversation, and it was really robust. And we had the good fortune of listening to the state of Washington, who between Seattle and their region is really very far in how they think about mobility. I'll use a small example. I don't know if you guys knew this, that 75% of the people who come into Seattle for their work do so either on transit or in carpool. That is a stat unlike any other in the country.
Literally. I mean, the problem is that it is the anomaly.
It is the anomaly. And I think that's one of the interesting pieces. And they have a lot of interesting things going on. They have a state law that requires their businesses and others to support how people look at multimodal travel. And tools like Uber, Lyft, scooters, and others are starting to integrate into that model. So we got to, you know, watch one of the sort of the game-changing regions, right? Seattle, talk about what they're doing. A lot of the others in the audience sat there and looked at it and go, 75% of their people are already on transit and or thinking about how they do carpool, shared rides, that kind of stuff. So how can we get there? That was some of the questions. So that was one of the discussions. But then we actually had some other discussions. One of the ones that I think was probably most interesting related to the public and to the private side. So I'll talk about the private side first. You know, what we asked the group, because we spent a lot of time having facilitated dialogues and, you know, that kind of stuff, rather than just like a lot of panel speakers talking to folks. It's, honestly, that gets a little boring sometimes, let's be honest. Even me, who I like to hear myself talk, I get bored listening to myself talk. But the question was this. For all of this to work, for mobility on demand to work, the public sector has to feed a public benefit. The private sector has to make money.
And people have to want to use it.
And the customer wants to use it. So it's those three pieces. So we actually talked about each of those pieces individually. So the first was about the public benefit, right? Equity, accessibility, how it feeds, how do you create these layers? The second conversation was about the private sector. And the question we asked everyone was this. We've talked a lot about the values of what we want to accomplish. Now let's talk about how do we make the public private sector money. And it was funny. And so to brainstorm among that, what does it take to make the partnerships and that kind of thing work such that you realize the benefit, but at the same time, you're making people money? And it was funny because I was having folks text me questions and answers, and one guy texted me and said, if this is our focus, we're doomed. He says, we're doomed. And actually, I challenged that question. I said, why? Because why
the
not?
The making money part of it?
Right. He said, we shouldn't be talking about that. And I said, no, we should. We should be talking about that. We should be able to have a good, robust conversation about what it takes to really make all this work. Because let's be honest, when you have 15 million rides a day on just Uber alone. Things are changing. And we also recognize that transportation is subsidized in a lot of ways. I mean, the roads are subsidized, the public transport is subsidized. And Lyft so and Lyft and Uber are subsidized. I mean, so how do you put all of this together? How do you think about the marketplace for this to really make it work? If we're seeing such benefits, how do we keep making it work?
Well, and more importantly, you can be in a room talking about this is the way everything should be and everyone should do this, and increasingly just describing what everyone says public transit should be.
Right.
But there's a reason that when this product came around, whether it's from taxi, whether it's from the city's transit at the time, yep, people flocked to it.
You're right.
And that talks to a, I think, not only a new great service, but more importantly, just a pent-up, unmet demand.
Yes.
And so forcing everyone to say, listen, this is what you have to use.
Yep.
Is no longer an option.
No, and I think people are realizing that, and that's why I wanted to sort of put it on the table, because A, the customers are going to it. B, I think we've seen enough studies out there to show that, yes, is it impacting people, and is it impacting public transportation, and is it impacting ridership? I think it's a fair thing to say. I think we're also, though, evolving to a point where we say, hey, we think that this could be a layered system, where that they are not necessarily competitive, but they are cooperative too. And how, what's that next step? You know, when you had the first, it's like any startup, you start and now how do you mature it? And is I'm going to call it, is there such thing as co-opetition, where you're sort of competing but cooperating all at the same time?
Well,
right?
The only alternative to that is to say, we're not being competitive in this environment, so we are going to eliminate you as an option.
Right.
And that, you know, basically, that we don't like some of the negative externalities, or more importantly, we don't like that people are choosing you over us, and because we're the government, we're going to say no.
Right. And I think you see that happening a little bit in some cities. They haven't quite yet opened things up, or they fight it, or they use regulatory environments and the like. And frankly, that's some of what we want to get into with the Alliance, is sort of what are those barriers that people have been talking about, and how do you get past that? And the reality is people vote with their feet, right? And that's what we've been seeing with mobility on demand. But while they're voting with their feet, you also see others who are sometimes being left out. And that's again, back to that public benefit. So how do they weave all together? And folks, we're living right in the middle of it right now. I mean, we're getting to watch it play itself out in every city, every region. And here's the other piece to this, and this is where the Alliance sort of comes in at a broader level. It's different every single place. What LA may do is a little different than what Chicago is doing. That is a little different what DC is doing, than a little bit different from what Denver's doing. And that's the trick. So that's some of the stuff we talked about. You know, what are the contractual, the regulatory, what are some of the barriers that really make these partnerships possible? And then the third part was the public. Right? And so that was the last parts that we talked about. And then sort of what is MOD? But the public piece of it is pretty simple. Does the public know what mobility on demand is?
Does the public care?
And do they care?
And should they?
We
talked about this briefly in kind of a prep call. And in my mind, the idea behind mobility as a service is that it's supposed to be so seamless and easy
that you don't know. Yep, exactly.
You know, that is kind of going to be the key. They probably will not call it mobility on demand or mobility as a service.
Yep.
And so I think that's the fact. I mean, the other thing too that's behind all this is that, you know, we're talking about ride sharing competing with transit and whatever, and we're in the grand schemes of things, we are talking about a tiny sliver of the overall transportation pie, because such a large majority outside of Seattle and Manhattan, mm-hmm, people just get in their own, you know, if we're going to say this can't happen unless it's absolutely perfect in every, you know, kind of solving everything, then you can't do it otherwise, then people are just going to drive.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, two things with mobility on demand is sort of how, especially in a more urban environment, how they fit together with sort of the public transport, how you create this sort of layered system, right? Can public transportation be a backbone to what is mobility on demand? So that's a big piece of it. But let's talk about the reality that the vast majority of folks also are suburban, exurban, or rural, right? And that was actually part of the conversation we had. We were like, can mobility on demand be rural? And you know, someone made an interesting comment and observation. They said, you know, first mile, last mile, this idea that maybe you take a Lyft, a light rail, right, becomes first 50 miles, last 50 miles, especially in a rural environment. And you know, another person made an observation that when you think about mobility on demand in an urban environment, it really is about mobility, right? How people are moving around. But when you start moving it out, it becomes more about accessibility.
Like an access, not accessibility exactly. necessarily in the right, just ADA sense,
yeah,
but from the
access to it. So access and opportunity services. To get to maybe a rural transit system that allows you to get to the hospital or to your doctor's office, but you're living further out. And the reality is we also know that Uber and Lyft and that kind of thing aren't in small town Sedalia, Colorado, and they're not, you know. And so, for instance, use an example. AARP just recently started, actually, a mobility on demand service, a ride share, a ride sourcing service, in Columbia, South Carolina. And so towns and cities, and I say towns more specifically, that haven't yet seen this service explode on their streets. And so what does it look like? How do you get people engaged in that? How, and especially in their case, seniors. How do you involve seniors who become less mobile, obviously, as they age, and but you still create these mobility services? So those are some of the things that I think we're starting to talk about. And back to the public, do they know, do they care what MOD is? Probably not. Do they want to be able to access it easily? Yes. What about those people who've been left behind and don't have access to it? Do they care? They do. And you know, how can I use it to get to my job? How can I facilitate figuring out, though, how I get back and pick up my kids from school? Because let's be honest, when people move into going back to their personal car, there are so many reasons why they do that. And so that's some of what we talked about in lunch. And I think, you know, what it shows are a couple things. One, we could sit and talk about this all day. Two, every city, lots of towns are starting to tackle this, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. And the private sector equally is trying to work with helping them figure out how to do that. And consequently, a lot of topics and a lot of issues come up, and that's some of what we'll be talking about, you know, even, you know, as we continue the discussion with the Alliance, with additional forums and outreach that, you know, that we're going to be doing too.
And so now you're the Alliance is being run by Washington State DOT Secretary Roger Moore.
Right.
And you know, and I saw.
And
when
he
I
also
saw,
has a co-chair, Chris Murray, who is with COPS. She's okay. The CEO of COPS.
And so I was gonna say, when I saw that the Alliance was being run by a state DOT head, my first question was, what does the state DOT have to do with mobility on demand?
You know, I think that's a fair question, because state DOT, in many's, you know, vision of it is someone who does your roads, they do your bridges, they do your interstate, right? And that's their job. And I think that a DOT is evolving rapidly, and a DOT is, again, about moving people, goods, and services. And mobility on demand fits squarely into that. What it does is it changes the paradigm, though, about what the focus is, right? You know, we used to judge ourselves and our metrics on the number of miles of asphalt you lay down, or the amount of concrete, or, you know, perhaps as you move into technology, your fiber and your technology infrastructure and the like. And now we start measuring ourselves on how many people you are moving, how you reduce congestion, your air quality issues. And there are some DOTs, Washington being one of them, who have put that squarely on the forefront of how they organize and how they're structured as a DOT. And so if we had Roger here, he would sit and talk to you very strongly about the need for a DOT to be leading in the space of how you think differently about how you move people. And how do you think about the partnerships with private providers and others about how you do that? You know, some DOTs are also transit agencies, some are not. Most mobility on demand that you see happens, frankly, in regions and in cities right now. But Washington State is one of those unique states right now that's looking at it from a statewide level, you know, and obviously most of it is concentrated in their, you know, in their, the upper piece there of the state, you know, in the Seattle, Tacoma region and such. But it is about moving people and goods. And this is the interesting part, you know, talk about freight. Freight's another interesting thing. You know, how do you look at on-demand use of freight in these systems, whether it's on city streets, dropping off packages and that kind of thing, or through your express lanes? How do you encourage and move people differently using pricing and time of day that you're doing stuff and all that? That's all part of mobility on demand, and that's the kind of visual, you know, that Washington State DOT has to some of that. And you see that sort of happening in some DOTs around the country, but others are not, you know, there yet. But that's also part of this alliance, is how do you continue to raise the awareness of things that are happening. It's fair to say that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people were not yet talking about connected cars and connected vehicles quite the same way they were. There were a few bold folks who were out there starting to move in some of this space more actively in DOTs, and then now others have really started to come along. So you always sort of have some who are definitely on the front cutting edge of it, and Washington State is.
So I'm curious, so having been at a state DOT,
right,
and this is a great conversation, so one of the things interesting about Washington is talking with the people there, they're not necessarily investing in implementing pilot projects, they're really thinking about building the infrastructure,
right,
to support the future. And so, you know, one thing I'm struggling with is this conversation's great, but one of the things going on in Washington as well is investment in public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So my big concern is, how can state DOTs and cities find the resources to staff up and keep up with everything going on when they need to do basic things like make sure the trash gets taken out every day and you have public safety?
Right.
And then on the kind of thinking of the public transportation side, you know, is there a danger of over-investing and becoming over-reliant on this idea of mobility service and it doesn't come to fruition, and then we didn't invest in public transportation and talk about a congestion nightmare.
Right.
So how do we balance that right now in this early stage?
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, I often think about mobility on demand with sort of different building blocks, and it's easy for us to talk about the mobility services piece, the part that goes on the street, right, or on the concrete or the asphalt. Hey, it's the Lyft, it's the Uber, it's the scooter, it's the this, and how do you weave all of those together from a customer perspective? But underneath that is the infrastructure services block, if you will. And how do you think about your roads? How do you think about your fiber? How do you think about your intelligent transportation system, your ITS architecture? How do you think about your data architecture levels that feed some of this? On demand means that you know enough to be able to facilitate an operations system that makes the system work as well as you can when it needs to happen. And the idea of mobility on demand is that you're inputting the customer mindset onto that decision process now in a way that maybe you didn't before. So I guess I'm going to come back to sort of your question, though, about investment, because I think that's a really interesting piece to that. So I'll use Colorado for an example. We had a $2 billion budget, give or take. And 70% of that went into maintaining the system that we had. So the reality is they're not driving on air yet, and that perhaps will come as we go to three-dimensional travel. But right now, they're still driving on either asphalt or concrete. And so you must maintain that system. So the question is then, do you add to that system? Do you add new data or add asphalt? Do you add new concrete? And, you know, everyone likes to say that data is the new concrete, right? You know, that we're through the data uses that we're going to be able to facilitate the more effective use of what we have out on the road, out on our built infrastructure right now. And I think that's where mobility on demand comes in. So the idea that you take the built infrastructure that you currently have, that you layer in new mobility services on top of that with data integrations that allow you to maximize the operations of the road much more effectively than you have in the past. The interesting trick that we're dealing with right now with mobility on demand is the services are coming so fast and furious that we haven't figured out that maximum operation yet. So take, for instance, if you're driving down a city street and your Lyft driver wants to drop you off, they typically just stop in the middle of the lane. Sometimes they pull over if there's curb space, sometimes they don't. And when they stop in the middle of that lane, right there, you've impacted the viability of the system. So, you know, just here's the example. For every second that a car is stopped or delayed, it causes 4 seconds of backup and delay behind them. So instantly, you are starting to create that system. And you know, take the staff coming off of New York City. I think their average travel times was, you know, or average travel speed was somewhere like 7 to 8 miles, which seems crazy slow, but 7 to 8 miles on the city streets. It's dropped to 4 miles an hour. And the reason I think it's dropped to 4 is, again, because of all these new services that you see impacting the stops on the street. So I'm going to come back to your question.
Yeah.
So you must continue to invest in maintaining the infrastructure. Can you expand the infrastructure? And I think that that's the question that's changing a little bit with mobility on demand. What do you expand to, and especially in a city? Do you expand a whole lane, or do you expand drop-off areas so that you can have mobility services use them more effectively?
Is it expansion or design and improvement.
Design improvement, right. How do you also capitalize on maybe the pricing sides and charging folks for the use of that in a way that we haven't before? Because the reality is you can use pricing as a way of managing the reliability of a system.
And that's the point. It's not even just design, it's prioritizing uses.
Exactly. So maybe I prioritize the use of that road for, I'm going to say, cargo delivery between certain hours of the evening and early morning, right? So that we can get just in time and you can get your fresh fish delivered right to your door right at the moment that you need it. And we prioritize that, we incentivize it through a pricing structure, and that we create enough of an infrastructure base to allow people to pull over and the like, so that it's also then off the road and out of the way by the time your rush hour comes in. All of those pieces fit together in the mobility on demand environment. And that's what DOTs are starting to look at. That's what city DOTs are starting to look at, is how those pieces fit together. Because it used to be, you'd say, hey, I've got travel times of X, 10 miles an hour, and I want to get to 15. Well, how do I do that? I add another lane. And that's the difference. And now you talk about the other services, public transit. Obviously, Washington State has been doing a bang-up job adding actual miles of light rail, commuter rail, and that has made a big difference for them. Other cities like Denver have done the same. Their congestion issues are still going up. They, of course, are faced, just like others, with huge growth. But again, I think what you're seeing is you're seeing one new layer to the system now. You have infrastructure, you have mobility services, you have operations services that are all feeding together in a way, frankly, that you didn't have before. And that's what people are trying to tackle and figure out, and then where to put their money to do it.
So one thing I'll say, you know, the in projects and investments and plans and policies that have allowed Seattle to have so much success in encouraging transit and encouraging carpooling and all that, were put together and kind of launched before Uber and Lyft ever existed,
right.
Before scooters ever existed. You know, part of me really does think that, yes, these things have new impacts and they would play into these factors a lot, but that the underlying roadway designs, you know, what, it doesn't matter if it's a shared dockless electric scooter or if it's 20 years ago, people on bikes that were trying to encourage people to
new bike
use,
lanes.
You
right.
know, that having safe, protected bike lanes and that infrastructure we've known forever is how you encourage more people to use it and to do it safely.
Right.
Is there a bit of kind of scapegoating of new technologies for decisions that were, you know, whether it's an actual dollar amount decision, you know, that they weren't able to afford, or a prioritization and political will question as to, you know, like you said, the big reason Seattle Transit, also among others, is that they have invested a ton into making their system amazing.
They have,
and so their system is just more competitive.
And their voters voted for it,
yeah.
Right? You know, and some, you know, in Denver, people voted for Fast Tracks, which put billions of dollars into new light rail. But when they were faced with adding a new sales tax that would improve transportation around the state, so your highways and others, they voted no. And so, yeah, that political will is actually a complicated kind of piece to it. And, you know, and also it's then what kind of lane you're putting in, you know, if, when you do it, you know. So bike lanes being one, protected bike lanes. Now we're starting to think about protected multi-use sort of other than car, anything but car,
yeah,
kind of lanes.
Then you don't have to. Then it doesn't matter what the latest fad is.
Exactly.
These are cars go here. Other stuff goes over here.
Exactly. Or these pull-out areas go here, and how you adjust
pick
all
up,
of that.
Drop off is a
is
thing
a huge,
that's always existed. It was going to happen.
It's always existed. Taxis, of course, have always been around, but it's become so much more impactful. And so, yeah, I think you raise a good point that it's complicated. And does technology become the scapegoat? The tricky piece for planning and technology is how you do your planning, how you do your traffic modeling, and how you do all of those pieces. And so we haven't even said the word autonomous yet, but I'll throw it out there. Once this shifts, if it shifts here in the next, let's say 15 years or so, into automated autonomous Lyft pickups, then what? And here's the trick. If I'm a transportation planner right now, working on a transportation plan, I use a traffic model. My traffic model does not yet account for all of the mobility movements of connected, the potential of connected cars or autonomous cars, how they actually move in lanes, how they facilitate the movement, and what they're going to do to congestion one way or the other. There's a lot of people who are thinking about a lot of this. They have done a lot of scenario plans and that kind of thing. But actual traffic models don't quite exist yet.
People have ever been right, though?
You know, they're like that, the trick, right? Yeah.
You throw a dart at a timeline, and then you tell me,
and you have
you
to
take
plan.
A plan from 20 years before, and we can just have a good laugh at how wrong it is.
Oh, I know, and that's the trick, right? And now, right now, people are trying to think about these multi-million, $100 million investments plus sometimes, and they're trying to predict it with a transportation world that, remember, scooters last year, 3 years ago, scooters weren't around. It was all about docked bikes, then it was dockless bikes, and then it was scooters, bam, 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 in each year. 10 years before that, Lyft and Uber didn't exist. So when you're talking about the rapidity of the change right now, it's so vast and so quick. Because why? Because you've got the private sector in there innovating in this space in the way they didn't before. So
and then doesn't that speaks to design the road and the uses that you desire, and then and basically through that, nudge the market to, you know, you're welcome to do whatever you want. If you know, these scooters are both, oh, it's total chaos, and also exactly what we've been trying to get people to be doing for
all
a while.
Once. Yeah.
So why don't we, if we build a safe, you know, a lot of the safety issues and the kind of clutter issues are very solvable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, rather than trying to keep up with, which the public sector, much less the planning and you know, STIPs and TIFs are never going to keep up with.
That's what your listeners really wanted to hear, was the word STIP and TIP coming into this conversation.
You'd be shocked. That's actually right in our wheelhouse.
But it's true. You have to, because that's how federal policy works. That's how we plan and pay for projects. You have to work it through these processes. And that's the big thing. And I think that that's where the Mobility on Demand Alliance comes back in, and sort of this evolution is just simply raising the awareness. Everyone's messing with it right now, but you've got other cities overlooking everyone's shoulder going, how the heck do we do this? And how do we plan for this? How do I invest my dollars wisely? And it's, I'm not going to say that one group's got it licked. Everyone is coming at it with slightly different approaches.
Everyone's looking for it. Easy.
Yeah, there's no magic bullet on this right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really isn't. But then how do you do it with the private sector partner? Because it used to be sort of just a public sector enterprise, right? Hey, we think about it, we build our roads, we know the assets that are driving on it, we've got these cars, and we've got, you know, and we've got these buses, and we've got these trains. And now you've got all this integrated service, and then so then let's talk about 3D. If you ever do go to vertical takeoff and landing, how would you integrate that into a transportation system? So it's fun to think about, but you're right, there's no silver bullet right now.
So if you have to pick one, if you have to pick one policy that you think would do the most to mm-hmm. help advance and, you know, embrace the best outcomes of mobility as a service, what policy is that?
So at a federal level, I think one that people recognize is really clear is flexible funding. And so, and everyone says, flexible funding, let me spend my money on what I want to spend it on, which is true. But this particular
That sounds like
space,
a state DOT answer.
That is a total state DOT.
That sounds like, I want more money and less strength.
It's a state DOT and a transit agency answer, right? And but I'll tell you, it's coming even more to the forefront now when you start looking at integration with private sector mobility providers and sort of how they all play together. So part of the MOD sandbox, and I'll go to that with the FTA that they started a little while back, was starting to look at different kinds of pilots that looked at how do you integrate these services so that they fit together so it's not as chaotic, but that there's a system behind it, you know, which is how we've engineered our roads for a long time. We try to create some systems after, you know, the chaos of the cars, we tried to start creating some structure around it. And I'll use an example. Los Angeles ran a paratransit service actually in partnership with Lyft. And paratransit is obviously, they did non-ambulatory, meaning, you know, these people were in dire health concerns, and so they were getting them to doctor's appointments, a variety of things. They were able to reduce their cost by 50%. in running that service. But the reality is they would not be able to use federal funds to continue that program to run it, and this is about accessible needs, because of the ADA requirements. Now, I'm not suggesting that you tinker with ADA necessarily, because that becomes a complicated thing.
I know. Equivalent services, I will say that definition needs to be modernized to this.
Yeah, and the way ADA works is that in for a penny, in for a pound kind of thing. If you're using federal dollars and you have to have ADA accessibility for every vehicle that might provide that service. Well, obviously not every vehicle right now that might be in a Lyft fleet is designed for that. As we know, there are lawsuits attached to that somewhere right now. So that's the kind of thing, is sort of how do you create flexibility and funds that maybe could facilitate better customer experience, which the Los Angeles or the Las Vegas experience had. Reduce cost by 50%, so more efficient usage of taxpayer dollars, but at the same time, knowing that it didn't quite hit all of the markers with some of the strings that are attached right now. So those are the kinds of questions I think that we and the Alliance are going to be sitting and working on for the next year, especially with the reauthorization happening, is what does a mobility on demand program really look like? You know, and I think it has a couple tenets for us. You know, it's accessible and equitable, sort of as basic tenets, that it supports and engages public transit as a backbone piece to it, so that it's, you know, together. That the question of data sharing becomes piece. How do we put order to things? We think about the data and we use the data to help manage our systems better. There's a lot of data floating around on the public side. There's a lot of data floating around on the private side. And how can that be integrated in a way that is also protective of privacy, but that maybe allows us to operationalize these streets better, right? So those are the kinds of things that we're starting to look at from a policy perspective. So the first answer though was flexible funding. I think that's the trick. But yeah, that is such a DOT answer. but I think it's
every reauthorization.
Right. But I will say this, you know, coming in with the Alliance hat on now, because we are public and private, I think the private sector partners also see the value in some of that as well, as they see the services they can and can't provide given some of those restrictions. And let's be honest, if you're a DOT or a transit agency with limited funds and you want to do a partnership but you can't, that becomes the hard part of it, right? So they understand maybe that value too.
Perfect. All right, well, listen, this was excellent. If there are companies, public sector, private sector, anyone out there that want to join the Alliance, want to be part of this, where can they go and where they can get more info?
Yeah, they can go on our website, modalliance.org, or frankly, they could just email me at aford@itsa.org. But you guys, thanks for a good conversation. I think it's quite interesting, and more questions than answers these days as we work through it all, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll look forward to having you back on after you do another launch today. Maybe you want to talk a little bit what's happening in D.C.?
Yeah, you know, in D.C. we had the opportunity to sit and talk actually about a couple things. Policy is the one, and sort of what are the policy issues that we need to be paying attention to, and then data sharing. You know, we talked about data being sort of the king of all abilities to operationalize and make things work really well, and there's a lot of questions about that, especially when you have private sector data and public sector data.
And just for the record, on our pre-call, we all kind of agreed that data could be three episodes of its own, and so we were going to focus on the other stuff, not to minimize the role of data, but just because doing a five-minute talk on data is kind of pointless, because it you can raise the questions we've all heard and not actually start to
not even scratch the surface. Yep.
Well, this was a pleasure. We really appreciate it. We're excited. This is a big week. We've got a whole series of interviews coming up, and we're looking forward to today to the Alliance forum.
Well, I look forward to it. Thanks again for having me on. Thanks, guys.